Hello, friends. My name is Blue Mitchell.
And I'm Michael Kirchhoff. And these are
the Diffusion Tapes.
Welcome to the Diffusion Tapes, a podcast where we chat with artists, writers, and curators working in the field of artfully crafted photography. Produced and hosted by Blue Mitchell, publisher of Diffusion Annual and founder of 112 Publishing. Co-hosted by Michael Kirchhoff, editor-in-chief at Analog Forever magazine and founder of Catalyst Interviews. In these conversations, we chat with folks whose fascinating work and intriguing life path arouse the senses. And we're inviting you into the conversation.
I'll tell you a quick story about Stu. I ran into him. This is, I don't even know, 2010, 2011, something like that. Mm-hmm. I was at Photo LA at the Santa Monica Civic in Santa Monica, California. I spotted him. And I just went up and I introduced myself and I talked to him. And he talked to me like we had been friends for years. Mm. I was just asking him, you know, what he thought of exhibits that were here. What was he working on? And he talked to me like we'd been old friends. He didn't know me from the guy next to me. You know, he had no idea who I was. I don't think. I mean, he couldn't have. But he was just so matter of fact about, like, this is what's going on. This is what I'm doing. And he was just friendly and giving. And he embraced who I was in the industry, even though he didn't really know. He was just an easygoing person who was willing to give of himself. And it was really nice to, it was very eye-opening is all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, that's funny because I had very similar experience with him. Same narrative, essentially.
Like, yeah.
I was at a gallery and we started chatting and I felt like, I felt like he knew me, but he didn't, you know,
right.
What I mean? Like that, you know, like he pays attention. He's very intuitive.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's it. Like he doesn't know you, but he does.
Exactly.
You know,
which in turn makes you feel like you know him because he's familiar. You know what I mean?
Correct. Yeah. And then you don't feel like there's no, you know, you don't feel any kind of like tension or you don't question yourself even, you know, you just ask honest questions and you get honest feedback from him. It's always that case. Every single conversation I've had with him in person since that point has been exactly that same vibe.
Well, yeah. Well, that's why we had him on the podcast because
right. We
knew that vibe.
Why I was excited about it.
Yeah, that's our vibe.
That's right. Just cool cats hanging out, talking about photography. And
yeah. Music. So we're talking about who? We're talking about Dr. Stu Levy.
Dr. Stu Levy. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, I love that part.
That he's a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Stu Levy lives in Portland, Oregon. So he studied with Ansel Adams and was an instructor at the Ansel Adams Gallery Workshops. And then he leads, he's continuing to lead workshops here on the Oregon coast himself. He has several books. Have you seen his books?
Grid Portraits.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a big favorite of mine.
So he has several books. His works are in many collections. Well, he's a Portland, Oregon icon, of course. He's currently heavily involved in the Portland Art Museum's Photography Council. And he's on the Photo Lucida board of directors. I think we talk about all that stuff in the tape.
Right.
And we've mentioned it already, but he has an extensive history in photography. You mentioned music. Mm-hmm. And then the lesser known healthcare, which he's been a doctor for a long time. In fact, we have a small world story there where I saw him at work and I was like, wait, we both work for Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah, that's a connecting point between the two of you that goes beyond photography.
Yeah,
I love
that. Yeah, it's great. It's fun. Yeah, because we used to work in the same building. So occasionally I'd see Stu come in and it was just like, oh, my two worlds have collided.
Right. Do you guys like cross each other in the hallway and like high five and give a knowing glance to one another? You're like, dude, hey, dude, what's up? So
yeah. Can you imagine Stu? He has that look and that smile. That's like all you need. That's all you need is that.
Yeah.
That Stu smile. It's like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stu's wealth of knowledge in regards to photo history is amazing. I think we could listen and learn for hours, which is why we invite him on the Diffusion Tapes.
Well, all this is what we wanted to address when we invited him to do the Diffusion Tapes this time around. He is a wealth of knowledge, and my mind is a sponge, and I wish to absorb all of Stu's knowledge. In not a parasitic way, but in a fanboy way.
In a fanboy way. Here we are, Diffusion Tapes, Season 2, co-host Michael Kirchhoff with Stu Levy. I like to call a Portland icon, but also, you know, an amazing photographer and amazing person. Instead of me jabber-jawing, I'm going to toss this right over to Michael right away and have him start us off.
Changing things up. Putting me on the spot. I have only a handful of questions because I had a feeling we were going to breeze through this because you've been at this so long that you have plenty of stories and plenty of specific outlook on photography and especially where it is today. I think that because of your longevity in the industry, I kind of wonder what somebody like you has seen change that is what's the most significant change that you've seen besides the obvious digital photography? Yeah. Because I know you had made a switch over at a certain point.
Yeah. Yeah. I switched from 4x5 to digital about 10 years ago when it finally came of age. I do think that the digital is the biggest revolution I've seen in that it has democratized the craft of photography. It used to be that as a photographer, you were committed to learning the technique and had to understand darkroom and exposure and whatever. And you weren't really sure if your image was going to come out until you saw the film. Whereas now everybody sees it instantly and the technology is so good that the technical stuff is there for everybody. And now it gets down to the fact that people are becoming editors. At least ideally they're going to become editors as opposed to just photographers because they take so many pictures. And I think that editing is sort of the lost art at this point. We used to edit before we made our photograph because it was going to cost us $1, $5 or whatever before we made the exposure. And now people don't think about that.
So true. Yeah, I agree. And in fact, that's kind of one of the things like when I'm doing portfolio reviews, things like editing and sequencing seem to always come up as something that most photographers need to spend more time doing and concentrating on.
And I think people don't really appreciate the sequencing in a lot of the great photo books, some of the classic books, The Americans, things like that. And the sequence is just so well thought out and so important. And again, in the reviews, I think it matters also. Although I read an interview with the violinist, I think I'm blocking on his name, but they asked what his sequence of songs were in a concert. And he says, you know, all that really matters is the first song and the last song. Everything else, people forget, but they remember those things. And that's really an important thing as far as sequencing, at least in a personal presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Start strong, end strong is kind of a mantra for the beginning mantra for sequencing, certainly. Yeah.
Well, as long as there's a climax in there somewhere, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Or two.
Right.
And realize for the most part, you're telling a story and you need to guide the person through it. It's just not really a random sequence for the most part, if you really are a storyteller. And most of us, I think, are storytellers.
Yeah, in one way or another, even people who do abstract work, I think there's a point of view that they're trying to get across, right? And that is certainly a story. So
yeah. Well, one of my influences is Minor White, and he did abstracts, but he had sequences, and the sequence was extremely important to him, and they were a fixed sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Something people need to think about.
The lost art of editing and sequencing. That, you're still teaching, aren't you, Stu?
Yeah, I do a couple of workshops a year. One on the Oregon coast and one in southeastern Utah.
Mm-hmm. Is that a topic that you teach usually, or is it, I'm sure it comes up at least?
Yeah, it comes up. We spend a lot of time on the craft. We do a lot of time trying to understand a person's artistic intent. You know, what are you really trying to say? And when they're really evolved, then we get into sequencing. Because mm-hmm. That's sort of like the fine-tuning part from my perspective.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things in the editing phase for not my work, but when I'm looking at other people's work, and if you have enough time to actually spend with them, is how different the story is if you resequence the work, you know, which I think is which is so much fun about photography, is being able to like, it's almost like in filmmaking where they can do a completely different edit for a film with the same footage and tell a completely different story.
And, you know, putting together one's own book is a good exercise. And now it's sort of an easy exercise, even if you don't publish it. But making a sequence of things is really helpful.
Yeah, it's true. It kind of goes across all mediums to a certain degree, too. I know it's especially in like music. How many bands have over the years have gone back to the early days of their catalog and remixed entire albums and been able to kind of bring out, you know, something different in the mix that kind of fleshes out the sound a little bit more.
Yeah, but some of the great albums, you know, a Beatles album or whoever, you know, we hear a song and then our brain goes into the next song automatically.
That's true.
The sequencing was just so important in those days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and now everything's by the song, whereas before it was all about the album, and especially some of the great concept albums of mm-hmm. all times, you know. Yeah, sure. There's a lot that we could mention, certainly, but I see a lot of correlation between photography and music.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, Stu, tell us about Surdy Grebus. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Surdy Grebus. So a buddy of mine in college had written a song. We showed it to a friend who was a producer, and he sent us to New York from Cincinnati to record a record. This is 1967, the Summer of Love. And we recorded a song. I said, okay, we got to get a band together. So we put together a band that lasted for about a year and a half or so in Cincinnati. And we were mostly a cover band doing Beatles, Bee Gees, Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Jefferson Airplane. And it was just a riot. It was great. We had a light show. We had a fog machine. We ended our sets with a 45-minute version of Jimi Hendrix's Foxy Lady and filled the place with fog. And everybody, every club owner thought we were trying to set the place on fire, so they never hired us back. So we played every place in Cincinnati once. And we were billed as the uncontrollable Surdy Grebus. And our lead guitarist went on to become a world-famous guitar pickup maker, a guy named Seymour Duncan. So anybody who knows electric guitars knows who Seymour is.
That's incredible.
He's still a good buddy.
Great. Oh my God. That's so great that you still keep in touch with everyone, or at least with him.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the nice transition there. I was like, I wanted to bring up that band somehow in this conversation.
Yeah. And back in those days, I used to photograph my own band, local bands, and bands that came through town. And so music and photography were very interrelated for me.
Yeah, so when I was at Stu's, Michael, he showed me some of the photos from that he shot back then, and the catalog it's phenomenal, actually.
I think the first year I ever saw concerts, 1965, the big three that I saw that year were the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. And at least for Dylan and the Stones, I could walk up to the stage and take photographs. And it was pretty amazing in those days.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What a different world it is now. And starting out with some of the greats, certainly. Yeah. I mean, did you have any idea back then that you were taking photographs that would really, I mean, last a lifetime and kind of, and you were photographing, you know, musicians, obviously, like the Stones are still around. Like, have any inkling that that was going to be the case?
A little bit. Because of being involved in music, we sort of, you know, we thought these folks were really important, you know, especially the Beatles, the Stones, and Dylan, which were probably the big three then. But I remember selling a lot of my Rolling Stones photos to the local Rolling Stones fan club for like $1 each for an 8x10. And that's how I earned money to buy paper.
Oh, that's great. Nice. Yeah.
Was there any restrictions to bringing cameras into shows? I mean,
not
nobody
in those
cared.
Days, no. Oh, God. And sometimes, because I had long hair and a Nikon, and they'll say sometimes I would even walk in the backstage door of places and people thought I was part of the act or part of the entourage.
Right. Yeah. It's funny that, yeah, no questions asked. That,
the old yeah. days.
Yeah. Long hair, don't care. So when you were making those photographs, I mean, I think you had in your history, you were photographing for like school newspapers or yearbook.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. First the high school newspaper, then yearbook, and then the college yearbook also. And I became the yearbook photo editor and designer and used some of those photos in the school yearbook actually as part of the narrative of what happened during the year. We actually mm-hmm. put together a 2-volume yearbook where one volume was the essay of the year and the second was all the organizational pictures. So hidden in the yearbook were, I think, Mick Jagger is in my yearbook, my senior class college yearbook, and a few other people. Peter, Paul, and Mary are in there because they played at the school. There's a picture of Pigpen from the Grateful Dead because I was wow. I was the concert chairman at school also and basically talked the school into bringing in the Grateful Dead for the Spring Arts Festival. So oh, wow. it was exciting times.
You must have been one of the most popular kids in school.
Well, I don't know about that, but I knew a lot of people because I was the photographer, and so I was visible. Mm. I don't know about popular, but I was visible.
Right, that kind of gave you a pass to you know special occasions, really.
Yeah, and fast forward to 2013, so 43 years later, I get an email from David Lemieux, who's the Grateful Dead archivist. He says, are you the guy who took this picture of Pigpen way back when? Do you have any more? And they end up using 5 of my Grateful Dead photos on a double vinyl album.
Oh, wow.
And that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Have you gone through, I mean, obviously everything was filmed then and it's all digital now. Have you gone through your archives and digitized all or most of it?
I haven't. Everything is indexed, but my fantasy is... If and when I ever retire, I want to go back through those and really edit them and pull out a bunch of them. I've pulled out a few that are on my website, a couple of Grateful Dead photos, Jimi Hendrix, there's Iggy Pop or Iggy Stooge. A few mm-hmm. of those I have pulled out, but I plan to do more. That's the fantasy.
Right. And I would imagine, I mean, I know it's happened to me, you kind of like look through past proof sheets and you kind of think, oh, why did I pass on that one? That one seems yeah. a little like that's a better option than what I had made before.
Yeah, whereas for me, it was more of just never getting around to it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you're doing it all of the time, it's easy for things to fall through the cracks, right?
Right, yep.
Well, also, you mentioned when we were talking about it, you mentioned that some of them were out of focus and you know, maybe not the best by photo standards, but really... Now, if you're looking at them in hindsight, you're like, these are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they're still historical. There's some great people in the photos. And I think the captured moments are good. It may not be the same technical level that I wish that I could have achieved, but it's the way it was in 1968, 69, 70.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still, I think, a good record of what was going on. And... You know, I love the music. I love making the photographs. So it's a good thing to have in the can.
Did you spend some time following the Dead around the country?
Not following, but I saw them wherever I happened to be. The most following was that for 13 years, once I moved to Portland, we would go to San Francisco for the New Year's Eve Grateful Dead concerts. Then on New Year's Day, we would drive down to Carmel for Ansel Adams' New Year's Day party.
Oh, my God.
and that was the tradition. But I probably, while Jerry was still alive, I probably saw maybe 75 Dead shows.
Wow. Right. That's
a lot. Which I'm told is average.
Yeah. 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 I don't think anybody follows any band around anymore.
I think old people follow Fish and
yeah.
a few people like that.
Yeah. I mean, This is totally off topic, but I think, aren't they retired as well?
No, they played last summer, I think.
Oh, okay.
In the Gorge.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about them. God, I should spin some discs.
You're getting old, Michael.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I think you're right, because one of my coworkers is a huge Fish fan, and she still goes to their concert. So,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. See, I just haven't been paying attention.
They're still fishing. So, terrible. Stu, you talked about Cincinnati. You grew up in Cincinnati, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
So everything through college and med school was then. Then I made my escape and came to Portland for internship and residency, and just fell in love with Portland.
Hmm. What was it about Portland that you loved so much?
Well, the friendliness of the city, the climate, the politics, the fact that it had a bookstore like Powell's, and the fact that the Grateful Dead played here. Hmm. So lots of factors.
Sure. Had the right ingredients.
Yeah. Yeah, Powell's was really important to me also, the bookstore, because at first when I got here, part of my photo education was going to the library and taking books out of the library, Adams, Arbus, Cunningham. And then I started going to Powell's, and I could buy these for a few dollars each, and essentially accumulated a photo library, which became my education. Hmm. And Powell's was on my way home from the hospital every day, so I'd stop there 2-3 times a week. And there was always something new. And again, just a great environment in those early mid-70s. There was no internet to be able to find things, and Powell's was just a great resource.
Mm-hmm. Portland lured Blue in as well, so
yeah, it's and actually a special place. Pretty much for the same reasons, for the most part.
And well, the funny thing is, we ended up working in the same place.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Oh, that's right.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, so so we both worked for Kaiser Permanente, but Stu, you started there, like, I found an archive photo of Stu from a long time ago, and I was like, oh my God, look at it, it's Stu.
Yeah, I'm with black hair and a lab coat that had a Mr. Natural Keep on Truckin' patch on it that nobody understood what it was.
Oh, that's incredible. I love it.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
That's right. I don't know, because you're like such a photography icon that I often forget about your background in the medical profession as well.
Yeah. So I did family practice. My wife was also a family practitioner, and we were both working full-time and going crazy. At least I was going crazy, because I had taken Ansel Adams' workshop just before I joined Kaiser, and working full-time, I had no time for photography. I started hating medicine, hating my patients. And we were finally able to convince Kaiser to let us share a job, to essentially work every other day. And once I was able to do that, I had time for photography. I enjoyed medicine when I was doing it. I had time for photography, and it really saved both careers. It was a really fortunate thing that happened to me.
Yeah, it seems to be very kind of forward thinking of them to allow you to even do something like that.
Yeah, well, when I first interviewed with them, they said, we've done it once, we'll never do it again. But then there was a change in administration.
Oh, right.
And they were open to it. So it was just the right time. So
yeah,
felt really lucky.
That's great. I mean, how great to be able to kind of, split your time like that and allow yourself to do exactly what it is that you want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that the person you were splitting your time with was your partner too. That's pretty, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So we would check out to each other at the end of the day and tell each other what to look out for.
That's great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I imagine it allowed for travel to be easier because again, looking through your catalog of images, especially on your website, I mean, you've been to a couple of places over the years.
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder, because I love travel as well, and a lot of my own work is kind of travel based to a certain degree. So I wonder, do you have a favorite destination and why that might be?
Yeah, a bunch. Well, the Southwest, the Four Corners area, fascinates me. Mm-hmm. The Southern Oregon coast fascinates me. I love the Big Island of Hawaii. But there are a few places in Europe I've been to. Sometimes, several times, and some I want to go back to. I love Prague. I went to Morocco and helped teach a photo workshop to Moroccan high school students there once. And Morocco is magical, and I would love to go back there. Parts of France I love. A group of former workshop students love to get together and photograph. And they said, well, we don't need to go to workshops to meet up with each other. Why don't we just go somewhere once a year? And they invited me to join their group. So we've gone to Scotland, to the Lakes District of England, done some Southwest things together. And opportunities like that are wonderful. And just poking around to see what kind of visual magic happens during the week or two that you're in a place, to me, is the fun of it. And I remember a baseball analogy with photography. It's like you're always, you know, you think you're going to get a home run every time you're up to bat. And not everything is a home run. You know, you're lucky if you get a single. You're lucky if you walk. Maybe it's a sacrifice fly. Mm-hmm. You know, but everything has a role, but not everything is a home run.
Right. Yeah. I remember I used to work for Alan Ross back in the day, I guess. Yeah. I'll say. And I remember, you know, because he worked with Ansel. Yeah. As his assistant for several years, and I remember him always saying, it's kind of not generally spoken about, but Ansel took a whole lot of really mediocre photos.
Yeah, right.
So, like, we all see the hits, you know, we see the home runs, yeah, but you don't see the singles. You definitely don't see the, pop fly to center field that gets caught. So. Yeah.
So Alan was the darkroom assistant at the first Ansel workshop that I took in 1979. Mm-hmm. And just as a call out to him, his darkroom demonstration, the way that he showed dodging and burning was almost like ballet. It was just so lyrical how he could do things. And he is just a master as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. He taught me a lot, that's for sure.
And at the same time, John Sexton was just hired as Ansel's assistant. Mm-hmm. And so we became good friends. We would stay up till 2 or 3 every night talking and looking at photographs. And, mm-hmm. and so I sort of fell into this at a fortunate time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you were definitely surrounded by some luminaries, weren't you?
Yeah. So another John Sexton story. I saw him. I went to Carmel a year later, and he was really happy that he had just gotten his first van and rented a first house. And he got the van had a camera platform on the top that he could photograph from. And his license plate, he got a custom license plate, Mr. Zone. I said, John, if you're Mr. Zone, I'm Dr. Zone. and I sort of used that ever since.
That's your your email address, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, is it really? That's great. Yeah. Oh, we totally outed him now. that's funny. It's like the van with the camera platform seemed to be like a staple item that everybody had to have. I mean, really,
right?
To hit the open road and make photographs as long as possible.
Stu, I'm curious. I want to rewind a little bit here. So I know you got into photography when you were pretty young. So was there, and it sounded like you were doing, you know, bands, and I mean, was the photography your interest, or was it the bands that were your interest? And was it, or, you know, like, basically I'm asking, what was this like aha moment with photography that kind of led you down this path to begin with?
Yeah, probably as a kid, you know, just when there were family photos to be taken, I said, oh, I can do this. You know, it looks like fun to do it. And then in sixth grade, a friend had a darkroom, and I saw a print develop for the first time and saw the magic of the chemistry. Mm. And I think at the end of ninth grade, there was a little notice in our school newspaper saying, anybody who wants to be on the photo staff, apply. And I was the only one who applied. So I became the school photographer. Uh-huh. And I was basically doing events and candids, and music was sort of interwoven with all that. And then it got more artistic, I think, as I got involved with the yearbook things and the same thing through college. So it was almost all people photography. There was essentially no landscape work at that point mm-hmm. in my life. So music and people, basically.
Sure.
And it wasn't until probably halfway through med school I started backpacking and would take the camera along and take slides and say, well, these are cool. And it wasn't until shortly after that, maybe a few years later, even though I'd seen Ansel's photos in books and things, it never really registered on a very deep level. But in 75, I think, the Portland Art Museum had a show of Ansel photos that I went to. And it was like the light was radiating out of the prints. And, you know, the images were cool, but the prints were just so incredible to me. I said, I want to learn how to make a print like that. And mm-hmm. as I got a few years into my residency and lost my sleep deficit, I opened up a dark room for the first time in Portland and tried to learn how to make a print, and ended up at Ansel's workshop a few years later.
Wow.
No, that's great. I was curious because, like, a lot of people would, with that background, would have just been photojournalists. You know what I mean? Like, would have just kept going with the photojournalism thing. And you just, like, went, okay, we're going to dive right into this, getting together and going to Ansel's workshops and stuff like that. I mean, you just dove right into this whole other realm of photography. And it kind of seems like you never really looked back.
True. Although I was at the Weston Gallery in Carmel on a rainy January day, and nobody else was in the place. And the woman said, what do you want to see? And I said, I want to see some Ansel Adams photos. And she probably pulled out 100 of them for us to look at. She said, what else do you want to see? I said, how about Edward Weston? And she pulled out 20 or 25. She says, what else do you want to see? I said, what do you got? And she pulled out a half a dozen Paul Strand photos. and when we're all done, I said, you know, I'm a photographer too, and I'm going to take a workshop from the Friends of Photography one of these days, which was an organization in Carmel that Ansel was involved with. She says, why don't you take Ansel's workshop? And I didn't realize that they were still happening. I said, well, what's wrong with the Friends of Photography workshops? She says, look, my husband is the director of the Friends of Photography. Take Ansel's workshop. And she gave me the phone number, and that's how it happened.
That's great.
And that was Mary Allender, who became his assistant. And Jim Allender had been the head. And Jim was actually one of the instructors at that first workshop. And the diversity of Ansel's workshops were amazing. So there was Ansel and his two assistants, Alan Ross and John Sexton. There was Jim Allender, Paul Caponegro, Roy D. Carava, Marion Patterson. So this wide range of people. You know, my goal was to learn how to make a good print. And to oversimplify, I learned that if you want to make a good print, make a good negative. And he taught us how to make a good negative. But the two big things I came away with were I got exposed to the world of photography as art. I got welcomed into the world of photographers as artists. And I'm not sure if that ever would have happened to me had I not gone to that workshop. And it changed my life totally.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing how, and the connections that you have made with all of these different people over the years that, yeah. I mean, to be immersed in the profession like that, surrounded by these people, I mean, it had to have been incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, and every year I would go down to either Yosemite or Carmel and be an assistant at one of the workshops. And it was master photographers that I became friends with in many cases. You know, Jerry Yulsman, Ruth Bernhardt, Olivia Parker. The list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Ruth, didn't you do some workshops or something with her?
Well, she was an instructor at a couple of the Ansel Adams workshops that I was at.
Oh, okay.
And we brought her to Portland once in the mid-80s to do a workshop, I think.
Okay. Did you get close with her at all?
A little bit. I mean, we knew each other, but not real close. I was a lot closer with, like, Jerry Yulsman and Olivia Parker and some of those folks. And Jerry, you know, I sort of circled back and started photographing people again in a project that I call the grid portraits. Mm-hmm. And Jerry was one of my subjects for the grid portraits. I ran into him in Aspen one year at a photo gallery. And I said, you know, I need to take your photo sometime. He says, yeah, but you're never going to come to Florida, are you? I said, you're right. And then an event came up. There was going to be a solar eclipse in Aruba in 1998 that I wanted to go to. And I realized I should go to Florida. I said, so I got in touch with Jerry and he was going to be around. So I did the eclipse. Then I went and visited Jerry and made a grid portrait of him. Mm-hmm. And we stayed friends until, you know, he just died this past year, but we stayed friends mm-hmm. the whole time.
Yeah, he was an incredible human being.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think he inspired a lot of us who, getting in next generation of photographers, for sure. Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in the photo council at the Art Museum here in Portland. We brought Jerry up here a couple times to lecture. And once we were going to the event, and there was this huge crowd of people in line to get in to his to his lecture. And he says, "What's going on here?" I said, "Oh, the Grateful Dead are playing."
That's good. It's about the same. Yeah.
The very first photo book I ever bought was a Jerry Eelsman book.
Yeah. So. Probably me too, Michael.
Yeah.
So you brought up the grid portraits, Stu. That's actually how I first discovered your photography was that series. Can you tell us how that kind of came about?
Yeah. The start was I was backpacking in Utah, camped in a huge amphitheater that was too big to photograph. It was a couple hundred yards long, and even wide angle lenses weren't enough. And I thought about David Hockney's technique of taking many photos of something. And I tried that with the 4x5. I did 9 images, and I also shot a roll of 35 millimeter film on it. And it looked, when I came home and developed it, it looked horrible. But I realized, technically what I had done wrong, which was I should have used a telephoto lens to isolate things as if they were brush strokes eventually. Mm. I did another landscape like that, but it didn't seem to have any purpose. The gutters of the 4x5 film sort of create a black line grid work across the whole thing. And I said, well, I'm going to try it one more time. And I went out to the Columbia Gorge to photograph a bridge. And Terry Todemeyer, who is a photographer and was the curator of photographs at the Portland Art Museum, was with me that day. And I said, Terry, let me do a picture of you here on the bridge. So I did a Polaroid of him and then photographed his face of him holding up the Polaroid. Then he put the Polaroid in his shirt pocket. So I tilted the camera down and photographed him from the neck and chest. Then I photographed his feet. Then I asked him to go somewhere else on the bridge and stand and photograph separately. Then I sort of connected all the pieces of the bridge, and that was the birth of the grid portrait project. And then I started photographing people that way, and oftentimes in 2 different locations at 2 different times. There's a pregnancy before and after in one of the photos. And I think of these as little movies of people's lives, and we remember one frame and scene and one scene from somewhere else and another scene from somewhere else, but they're combined together as if they all happened at once. And and that's what the grid portraits are like. They try to show more than one aspect of a person and show their environment. And I should say also, it was a time that my wife was somewhat critical of the clutter and stuff in my life. I said, well, other people have stuff also, and it defines them. And so the stuff in people's environment became a big element in the photos also. Mm-hmm. So you could almost, you'd see the photo and say, oh yeah, I know this and this from their environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, didn't you also sneak a little self-portrait into some of those too?
Yeah. I think out of the 30 some of them, I'm in all but 3 of them. Yeah. I keep showing up.
Yeah. That's great. See, I love that. It's like we were talking about storytelling, and what you did with that whole series was like, it's this robust, it's not just a portrait, it's like this, it's like you said, it's like a mini movie of that person in one, presentation essentially.
Yeah, and I'm always trying to decide what role I had in the thing. and in the photos, I photographed on Polaroid film then on real film. So the Polaroids also became an element in the photo, as well as the Polaroid packaging stuff. So so usually there's a photo of the photo within the photo. And I like the layers. I like the transparency. I like showing that there was a real process going on. And that was fun to me also.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why I love that body of work so much, because it's often like when I'm interviewing other photographers, creative process is a major topic. And, what is it about your creative process that's different, and how do you go about it? Those grid portrait photographs are literally the complete embodiment of the creative process, because you see elements of what you were working on along the way, because there's, each one of those sections is kind of a timestamp.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And the fact that you're in them too is great. In fact, I believe there's one that you're not even wearing pants. So... what your role is as the photographer, one I wonder, but that's okay.
And just to explain that one, there was a poster made of a man in a trench coat flashing a nude statue in downtown Portland. The man, Bud Clark, was later elected mayor of Portland. And so, and so I asked Bud if I could photograph him in his office. And he was very gracious, and he let me have almost free access to his office while he was at the city council meetings downstairs at City Hall. So I could do whatever I wanted to in his office. So in one of the selfie part of his was that I stood on his desk in a trench coat flashing out the window.
And so,
there is some reflection in the desk surface, but you really can't tell exactly what's going on, and I'm not gonna go beyond that.
That's awesome. A self-portrait. Yeah, that's great.
And the title of that is Expose Yourself to Art. Or somebody else gave it a subtitle. They said, "The old gray mayor, he ain't what he used to be."
Well, that photo, I remember when I first moved to Portland, I used to frequent a coffee shop, which was down in Goose Hollow, and they had that picture up on the wall, and then I didn't know anything about Portland history at the time, but they were talking about this being the mayor, and and him flat. I was like, oh, Portland is definitely my place.
Really? So there's a pants optional clause to living in Portland.
Really? I'll mention one more thing about the grid portraits. They're all shot on 4x5 film, and usually there's 16 to 20 negatives that I would juxtapose. And to print them, I would tape them together with little pieces of tape in the corners, and it became very complicated because the exposures and contrasts were different because they were done at two different times in two different spaces. And I would create this elaborate thing with ruby lith masks and pin registration and a vacuum easel. And I would expose two or three of the images, turn off the vacuum, put on a new mask, and keep doing that until I was able to finally digitize everything and make inkjet prints, which simplified my life. But it also allowed me to make enlargements. Originally, I actually made some darkroom enlargements. I would do a 20 by 24 of each frame in a borderless easel, and I took some black seamless paper and taped it to a gallery wall. I got some push pins and painted them black and used the push pins in the corners of each of the 20 by 24s. So it became essentially a 6 by 10 foot installation. And at that size, you really started to see everything that was going on.
And right.
I think I've done four of them that size, a couple of them that are maybe 4 by 6 feet, and a few of them that are like 2 by 3 feet. And the enlargements really, really let you see what's going on because of the 4 by 5 detail.
Absolutely. Wow, I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Have you, Stu, done a digital large scale versions of them?
So the amphitheater that I mentioned originally that was the failure, I went back a few years later and photographed it, which is on the cover of the book. But I have about a 40 by 50 inch print of it here in the house that I've made of it that I'm in love with. I made one set of digital prints of an image where I took each vertical column of four images and we made it a 2 feet wide by 6 foot tall strip. Framed five of those together and hung them. So it was a 6 by 10 installation, but it came apart really easily. The Halle Ford Museum in Salem actually just bought one of those portraits of Gordon Gilkey, who was the late curator of prints at the Portland Art Museum. And so just seeing something large like that is like the full expression of it to me.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting, too, taking the option when the ability to do so comes up, taking that option to create something new with a photograph you had made, years and years ago. Yeah. I think is very, very telling because you kind of, we mentioned storytelling. You're kind of telling that story all over again, and being able to see the images that big, again, you bring out so many different details that you wouldn't normally pick up on.
Right.
That you really kind of have a chance to take something old and make it new again.
Right. So I had a show of these that included a few large ones at the Stephen Josephsburg Gallery in the early aughts. And a man walked up to me afterwards and said, I'm a book publisher. My name is Chris Pickler, Nasrallah Press. And I have a series called the One Picture Book Series. They're little 5x7-inch books that have 8 pages and an original print, limited edition of 500. And I said, he said, I would like to reproduce your grid portraits in it. I said, Chris, to have these things reproduced as like a 3x4-inch image, you just couldn't see what was going on. It wouldn't work. But I said, what if we, I knew a little bit about publishing. I said, what if we took the signature without, before it's folded and trimmed, and make one image that's the size of the full signature, maybe 13x17 inches or something, and make an origami fold of it as the book. So you open this thing up and it's one page and one picture, basically. And that was my first book.
Wow.
I didn't realize
that's how it was done. Your first book had one photograph.
One photo and one page.
That's great.
And it was of a Rochester photographer, Carl Chiarenza, who I had met a few years before and became friends with. And I had sort of learned about this, that there were some variations of his names with anagrams that were interesting. So I played with it some more. And we called the book Cranial Czar A, which is an anagram of Carl's name. And, nice. And that was the first book. And then that eventually led to the big grid portrait book and then a second one picture book of Jerry Uelsman also.
Hmm. Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Same format for the one picture?
Yeah, for Jerry's. But for the grid portrait book, everybody has a fantasy of doing a book. And I had made two or three pages as a mock-up, but I just never got around to it. And finally I decided, okay, I just got to do this. And I sort of plowed through in a couple of weeks and made an 11x14-inch mock-up of the whole book where I printed everything with folds. I decided I didn't want any image to go through the gutter, which meant that every image had to be a gatefold. And I showed it to Chris Pickler. I'm not asking you to do anything. I just need some advice, some feedback. And he said, first of all, this would be a very expensive book to publish. Number two, this is the worst time in the economy. This is right around the 2008-2009 stock mm-hmm. market crash. Mm-hmm. He said, but I have to do it. and he figured out that if we reduced it by 1 inch to 10 inches by 13 inches, it would become economical as far as a press run. So he did it. He let me design the whole thing, except for the typography, which he did. Mm-hmm. And everything is a gatefold. The title and the story about the person is on the left side with a teaser, two 4x5s, then you open it up and see the whole image. So you can read the story while you're looking at the photo. And it was just the book of my dreams. I was just so lucky to have that happen.
So it was the book of your dreams. Is that like was that like a pinnacle for you? Like, were you saying, I want to do a book and it has to be this way? Or was that just something that just kind of came to you and you're like, okay, now I got it, right?
Well, again, I had the design in mind, but to have it actually realized, designing something and even making a one-off isn't that big a deal, but to have somebody, number one, believe in you, and number two, make it a physical reality, was just amazing.
Right, especially somebody like Chris.
How many did you print?
We did a run of 1,000.
Thousand, yeah. Nice.
Are they still available?
I have the last copy, so get in touch.
There we go. Yeah. There's the sales pitch.
He's going to get flooded with emails now.
Right, exactly. Signed copies.
Go to my website, and there's a way to get in touch with me.
I love it.
Well, you might be able to find a used copy somewhere if you're checking eBay or something.
They're floating around. Yeah. I'd probably sell them for the same price as a used copy.
Well, I mean, that's kind of that leads me kind of to another question as well, because it's something that I picked up, in the fine art industry, of which I was kind of immersed in through Alan. I always used to, look at edition sizes, and edition sizes in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s were usually quite large. And nowadays, they continuously get smaller and smaller and smaller. And now we see more and more unique work. And then we also see it in book form too. So, you know, especially when it comes to like an interesting or kind of offbeat design that most people don't do. Do you have your own edition sizes shrunk over time as well?
Yeah. Originally, I took a purist stance for black and white images, saying there's no reason for a black and white image to have to be limited. You know, it's not like the negative is going to deteriorate. Ansel never limited anything. The galleries put a lot of pressure on me to limit things.
Right.
So I said, okay, I'll limit things to 75. And there were four images that I had already sold more than that of, so I left those as unlimited. There's one image I have which is almost sold out of its edition of 75 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the others are, you know, nowhere close. So now I've said, you know, I'm not going to be around for another 40 years. I'll be lucky if I'm around for one. Let's still limit them, but I'll call them editions of 15. Even that's over optimistic, probably. Because I'm not very aggressive about selling things. It's not in my personality. But that's a reasonable number of images from my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree as well. I mean, even though it was the gallery model calls for a tool like scarcity breeds value to come into play in order to make decent sales, at least in terms of dollar amount. So I wonder also if you're a working photographer, if you're a working artist, you're not no longer, you know, if you're not retired, you're going to continuously make work. So you'll always be creating something new that you can get up to 15 of, or whatever number that you choose. Yep. So why not just kind of limit to that kind of a number?
Yeah.
Even though I do know, so, like yourself and a few other photographers, especially images that were made in like the 70s and the 80s, you know, they'll sell 75, 100,
mm-hmm.
you know, prints of, so...
It has happened.
Yeah.
and the one image that's almost out of print now, I've actually been very reluctant to sell the last three or four images because I want to make sure that they go to the right place. And I'm trying to decide, you know, should this end up in an institution, or, you know, who should have it and stuff like that. So it's, I'm sort of holding off on those last few copies right now.
Are they silver?
Yeah. It's my Golden Gate Bridge sailboat and shadow image.
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Yep. A classic.
Yep.
Yeah, where I totally failed my assignment to make a photograph of the Golden Gate Bridge.
But at the same time, it's a very iconic image of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah. So. There's no other bridge that has that same shadow, that same
format. Right.
So.
Yeah.
No, I'd say it was a success.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, I lived there for a few years, and I'm instantly drawn to pictures of that bridge. You know, it was a kind of a, that's the kind of a place that you can go to. You can cross it like every single time I ever crossed that bridge. Like, it was kind of a special thing to do that. You know.
So this came out of a project that came from Mary Virginia Swanson from Swanee, where there was an ad campaign for Bank of America, I think. And they had used several photographers over the years, and they were looking for next year's batch, and I applied and was chosen. So I did these images, but they said, before you go photograph, we're going to show you the previous photos that were made. We don't want you to do anything similar. And it was a bunch of unknown photographers like Alan Ross, John Sexton, Michael Kenna, Morley Bear. And so my first half a dozen ideas went out the window, but I spent like three-day weekends walking across the bridge and back and forth and everywhere around and just every viewpoint I could. And to me, the sailboat in shadow was the most original photo that I came up with from it. As I submitted it, they changed their advertising director and ended that campaign, so it never really got fully realized.
Oh, that's too bad. World.
But on a personal project level, it was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it really pushed me to places that I might not have gone easily otherwise. I would have been satisfied with stuff that I had preconceived. before. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got the idea of photographing the shadow, went out one day, and it was too late in the day, so I went back a couple hours earlier the next day, waited until the shadow was exactly right, saw a sailboat outside the frame of my 4x5, and I said, it would have been neat to have had that in the image, but I can't reframe that quickly. And in the next half hour, three or four boats went right through my frame, and the one that I photographed was my favorite of those. So mm-hmm. Again, Ansel used to say something like, chance favors the prepared mind or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
So
that's great.
It was neat.
Well, Stu, so some of the other things I wanted to chat with you about was, you know, we've covered a lot of your photography, but I mean, you're so involved with the photo world in other aspects. I mean, you're on the Photo Lucida board. Do you still do work with Blue Sky in town?
I don't. I was actually never part of their structure, although I showed there a couple times. Hmm. But I'm on the board of the Photo Council at the Art Museum. Mm-hmm. My community involvement sort of started with the Ansel Adams workshops, in that another photographer in town who I'd met, Stuart Harvey, who I bought a camera from and became friends with, he was a student at the Ansel workshop where I was an assistant the first time. And driving home from that, we were just so charged up and so excited. We said, we need to keep this energy going. And we essentially started something called the Portland Photographic Workshops, which had some monthly meetings for print sharing or discussing techniques and some field trips. And eventually it morphed into an organization called the Portland Photographers Forum, which is still going on, even though Stuart and I aren't involved anymore. But the concept of getting a community of photographers together to share their passions and their artistic intents was important. There were at least two other groups going on in Portland at the time. One called the Inner Light Society, led by Shedrick Williams, and also the Interim Workshop Group, which was a group of ex-minor white students that met monthly. And there was also Blue Sky that was essentially a co-op and had monthly meetings. And so there are all these different groups. And I started to reach out to all of them and sort of became a little bit of a bridge. I became friends with Terry Todemeyer at the museum, who was also, he was no longer involved at Blue Sky at that point, although I became friends with Chris Rauschenberg. The Interim Workshop invited me to join their group. So all of a sudden, I think that we got all the diverse groups in Portland talking to each other. And it really developed into this one very cooperative community where it wasn't competitive in any sense. It was very supportive. And I think that was a very unique thing about the Portland photo community.
Sure. So this all started like in the early 80s, correct?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. What role did you play with like Photo Americas?
Yeah. So Photo Americas was an idea that was hatched sort of an offshoot of Photo Fest in Houston by Greg Mankiller, Guy Swanson, who had a gallery, and Chris Rauschenberg. And they said, can we replicate this in Portland? And as they got things together, they asked me to help participate in an auction that they were putting on. As a fundraiser, and then I became part of the organization and became on the board and have been involved ever since. And Photo America's morphed into Photo Lucida, so that was the roots of that. Huh. Yeah, so that was the entree to that one.
What year was that?
Either 1999 or 2000. Somewhere right around that.
Wow.
And at the same time, it was probably a year or so later that, as Photo Lucida brought people to town, some of the people were from Houston, from the Fine Arts Museum there and from Galveston. And we asked the Houston people how they raise money to buy photos because we didn't have any budget. And they told us about the idea of a photo council where members would throw in money that was dedicated to purchasing photos for the museum. So we met with them and we essentially put together a photography council at the museum. There had been councils for other collecting areas, but not photography before. So I was in on the ground level of that one also. Hmm. And that's still going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm curious. So, you know, Michael and I, when we talk to other photographers and curators, it seems like one of the biggest common theme is about the photo community. Is that one of the reasons that you're still so heavily involved? Is this like, you know, gracious community that, I mean, not just in Portland, but, you know, the photo network all over.
Well, I think it goes back to the thing I said about my lesson from the Ansel Adams workshop, learning about this world of photographers as artists. There's this network out there that, you know, both of you are involved in. There is such a strong bond, I think, in the photography community that's unlike any other professional group I've been involved with. There's somewhat true of musicians, but certainly not the same in medicine or in several other things I've been involved in. There's just this camaraderie that I think is unique, and I don't even think it exists in other arts the same way. Again, maybe a little bit in music, at least within genres of music. Mm-hmm. But in photography, I think that the community extends even beyond genres of the art. So a landscape photographer and a person making construction things and a person doing street photography are all still supportive of one another. Sure. And that's a fairly unique thing.
Well, I guess that leads me to one of my other questions. After being a photographer and shooting and obviously being involved with music and all these other things, what keeps you shooting now?
Couple things, I guess. As far as, you know, I'm still photographing at least some musicians whenever I get a chance. Mostly it has to do with some people who have become friends who are part of a Grateful Dead cover band here in Portland that I photograph a lot because I enjoy the music and I enjoy the act of photographing, trying to capture a moment or the lighting that's going on. But as far as my photography and the landscape and other things I do, I'm looking for something that's going to fascinate me. And I have a concept that my favorite photographs tickle my retina. And I'm looking for events that tickle my retina. And if I'm lucky, I can make a photograph of it. So it's a fascination with the world. A lot of it has to do with nature and events in nature, whether it's weather or lighting or whatever. But sometimes it's just design and composition. Sometimes it's cultural or architectural. But it's something that imprints on me and, again, excites my nervous system. So I can't imagine ever tiring of that quest.
Mm-hmm. That really makes sense because also, you know, like when I was asking you earlier about some of the favorite places that you like to go, and you mentioned places like the Oregon coast and Four Corners region, those are all kind of places that to a certain degree have kind of a spiritual sense about them. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the photographs that you've captured there, you really have documented that. So without being, you know, quote unquote religious, there is definitely a spiritual quality that we see in your photographs. And I think a lot of photographers kind of feel that.
Yeah. And I think back to some books I read in the 60s and 70s called Don Juan and the Yaqui Way of Thinking by Carlos Castaneda. It had to do with peyote philosophies. But there was a concept about feeling safe and having a spot in any danger situation or any precarious situation where you were protected. If you could find your spot, you were safe. And I feel like a lot of times in photography, I am attracted to a physical spot. And it's because there is an image that's going to present itself to me. And I tell my students often that I have what's called the 180-degree theory. You find yourself someplace and you see something, make the photograph, but then turn around because the real important thing may be right behind you. It's just that you found the spot to put your feet in your tripod. But mm-hmm. but there's something about the power or the energy in that place that has pulled you in if you're in tune with everything.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's a zone that I get into in those places where time stops, basically.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. It could be 5 minutes, it could be an hour, and, you know, who cares? Whereas if the light isn't good or the situation is good, you know, I'm looking at my watch and stuff like
right.
that. So,
yeah,
so it's trying to get into that zone. And whether it's in photography or in music, to me, it's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I can completely relate to that because I remember when I was first taking up photography, I was at the Oregon coast shooting a sunset. And so I had that place, and, you know, I was standing there for a while with the tripod and, you know, enjoying it, you know, and I was pretty new to it. And I just physically turned around as the sun was going down and saw a full moon over the top of these trees. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm totally missing the shot when I was so focused. Yeah. But it was just the environment was like, okay, I turned around and I just was like, and the better photo was the one of the moon and the trees yeah. behind me. And luckily I was, you know, I got it, but it was such an experience of like, oh, I can see that tool of the 180 being it's huge, yeah. for sure.
And there's one particular place at Bandon that I have it's like this huge offshore rock that's a couple hundred yards long, but there's a tunnel through it, and you can get sort mm-hmm. of behind it. And I often go behind it and photograph the opening and the rock pattern, and I've done this 40 times maybe over the years. And 2 years ago, the way there's a little pool and the sun came up, hit the pool, and the ripples of the sand underneath it gave these rays of light that came out that I'd never seen before. And it's, you know, just something I never would have expected, but it had to do with the place. And it waited, you know, 30 some years before it finally presented itself to me.
That's an interesting question, Stu. Do you re-photograph the same spots over and over? Is that something that you do in your practice?
Yeah, at Bandon I do. There's a finite area, and there are several offshore rocks that I photographed, and the lighting is different every time. So that's a place I go back to over and over again. And there are a few of the other Southwest places I go to over and over again. But Bandon is probably the most frequent place, and Shore Acres, which is a state park also on the southern Oregon coast. That's another place I go to over and over again, and it always looks different. Even though at Shore Acres, it's a rock formation, but the lighting is different, and I see things from a different angle each time.
Sure.
I think the downside risk of being a landscape photographer is you have to be out there. So I enjoy being out there, even if I don't make a photograph.
Right.
Yeah,
you have to be okay definitely. With that. Yeah,
I feel definitely very much the same way.
Is that, do you do that, Michael? Do you repeat a location?
I have, yeah. I mean, there's, like Stu, there are certain destinations that I love going back to over and over again, even if I'm not making photographs. But there have been a couple of places that I've made repeat visits to make photographs. Yeah. The time of day, the weather. I mean, there's so many different factors that can come into play in a singular location. In fact, there's actually one, there's an idea that I've had where I wanted to, I'm not going to say where, but I wanted to grab an 8x10 camera and for some reason shoot this in color. Even though I generally shoot most of my stuff in black and white, I wanted to shoot in color and just stay up for 24 hours and photograph the same spot once at the top of each hour for 24 hours and present that as a singular installation. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. the amount that of things that change in an environment like that is significant. So yeah.
I should mention also in my photograph of that canyon, the amphitheater in Utah, each section of that was done at a different time of day that I thought the light looked best for that particular frame. Wow. So almost analogous to your thing, but there are juxtaposed frames where one is front lit and one is backlit.
That's great.
So it would never look that way at once. But again, that concept of time,
yeah,
I think is very
certainly.
Cool.
Yeah, that's definitely that. Yeah, capturing time, I think, is an incredible concept in photography, whether they're just long exposures or multiple exposures over the hours.
And in the grid portraits, again, the before and after pregnancy photo that I made, mm-hmm. the couple is 8 months pregnant in the original photo. Then I went back 9 months later and photographed them with the baby.
Yeah.
At first, the baby was just at the mom's feet. And then the dad said, well, I'd like to be in the picture with the baby, too. And so the baby's in the picture 4 or 5 times.
That's great.
Yeah, I love it. That's like a metaphor for photography, really. That's how I've always felt about it. So this mm-hmm. is capturing of time and place, really. Well, speaking of time. We should probably wrap this up. Michael, do you have any final questions for Stu that we should be hitting before we wrap up?
I just mentioned it about, you know, working myself. The difference of between shooting black and white and color, because a quick perusal of your website, it's obvious that the majority of your work is in black and white. And this is a question I've asked other people as well, but I think it's a decent question. But there are some color images kind of scattered throughout. How do you make those decisions, and why the majority is black and white versus color?
So I started to dabble in color in the mid 80s, but I couldn't find a satisfactory way to print them. And so that was right around the time that the grid portrait project started. So I essentially abandoned color at that point. Then 10 years ago, when I transitioned to digital and finally found a full frame camera that I was happy with and had the quality that I wanted, I still thought in black and white. And I even changed the proportion of the viewfinder to 4x5 in my digital camera. Because I think 4x5, I shot it for 30 years. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I went to Morocco in 2015 and photographed in a town called Chef Chaouen, which is also called the Blue City, where all these doors and gates are painted various shades of blue. And I looked at these and I said, these just won't communicate the same way in black and white. And that was the first time I made a full-out effort to show work in color. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've sort of taken things on a case-by-case basis. I feel like I still see in black and white, but occasionally the color is so important to the image that I keep the color file. Mm-hmm. So it was a real transition point for me. And I allow myself to show color if I think it's really important, but I still love the abstractness of black and white.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's you tend to focus more on the composition of the image and you mentioned the abstract qualities. Yeah.
And the formal aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something about black and white and the way light is treated in photography is what's really exciting. Yeah.
But every now and then the color is just really integral to it. So I reserve the right to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you should. Great.
Thank you for that.
I have a prescription for everybody.
Oh.
Let's hear it.
Take 2 pictures and call me in the morning.
The doctor is in.
Excellent. Yes, right.
That's great.
I'm just glad we didn't have to read your handwriting.
That's lovely. All right. Well, thanks so much, Steve, for joining us. Yeah. I really, really appreciate it.
Sure.
Yeah, this has been wonderful.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Of course. Yeah.
And next time I'm in Portland, we're all hooking up.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
What we really learned along the way is, in addition to photography, I'm a big fan of music, as are you. Mm-hmm. And we learned, there were always hints that was the case with Stu, but we learned more about his connection to the music industry and the parallels between his love for music and photography both, and how he kind of connected those dots.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, even that he... It's funny, I think I asked him, like, how did you get into these shows to photograph? And he's like, I just went and took photos.
Yeah, that's all it took. I showed up.
That's all. Yeah, all I had to do was just be there with my camera. And I was like, oh, yeah, like that, things are different, you know, trying to get like up close photos. People do them on their iPhones now. But there was a moment where, like, you wouldn't be able to really bring a nice camera without having some sort of press pass, you know.
Correct.
It's like, yeah, it just didn't happen.
Yeah, everybody had a camera, you know, and there are a lot, but some people were more serious about it. And somebody like him, basically, he just stepped up and said, hey, I'm here. I got a camera. Like, I love what I'm seeing. I want to document that and share it with the public.
Yeah. And then he did, because he worked for the student newspaper at the time. So he was able to like publish. Right. He was able to publish some of the stuff in the paper. You know, a lot of these people, of course, became huge. That he went to see, or were huge at the time too. So he's got some great classic photography of people, you know, and it's like, these are just Stews, you know, which is great, you know?
I mean, think about that. Oh, I work for the school newspaper. Can I come and photograph the Grateful Dead concert in its entirety?
Not right. just the first song or the first three songs. Like, I'm going to be here for 3-4 hours taking pictures for my school newspaper. And the band's like, yeah, that's cool. Sure.
All right. Because
there's no publicist in the way. There's no manager in the way.
Right.
There's no, what are you going to do for us? And no, you don't have the rights and all that. Like, come on.
Yeah. It's just all organic.
It was one big happy family.
Right. Yeah. Because he befriended a lot of people, went backstage, took more personal photos too along the way.
Yeah. I mean, that's when you get into some, like, you know, more intimate types of portraits with some of these people who are, you know, iconic in the music industry. One of the things that I learned about Stu and deeply respect is that he keeps an open mind towards learning and growing as an artist. I think that's an important aspect to working in the visual arts. I have an immense amount of respect for someone who had always been a film shooter. I mean, that's all there was at the beginning, right? In the beginning, there was film. And then he found, he found a way to transition into the world of digital photography as well. And he did it obviously later in life, but he waited until the tech became good enough and the time was right to make that transition. And he was astute enough to be able to spot when that was right for him and then to make that transition and now be able to make photographs that are just as good. I think the viewer, and I mean, from a personal perspective, is I think that the images are just as good, if not any better, than what he's always done.
That's the one. That's the beauty of Stu's photography style is he went from film to digital, but it's hard to know the difference because stylistically, it's still Stu.
I especially love, like so many other people, the grid portraits that he had done because I'm a big fan of examining the creative process. And that's exactly what they show. They show the creative process in action in so many of those grid portraits because, you know, they're large format masterpieces. He's documenting people, time, and the process. Like sometimes you see the actual Polaroids in the final photograph as he's been making them. Like they're a part of, you know, you see him, you know, he shows up. One time without pants.
Gonna bring it up again.
There's no judgment behind it. I mean, who among us have not gone sans pants at one point in their career?
Especially for a portrait shoot and somebody.
Especially for a portrait shoot, yeah. I mean, if you gotta take off your pants, you gotta take off your pants. That's fine. If I'm gonna get the shot by taking off my pants, it's gonna happen.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think the current term for something, the way that the grid portraits portrays itself is sort of meta, but it's really more like a, you know, it's a great photo of a person and their environment. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about one style of photography, but then there's the self-portrait element to it. And then there's the, you know, showing so much of what the process is with film edges. And, you know, there's just, It's so loaded, you know, like showing the camera and showing, like you said, showing the film, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Such a great project.
It's also a document of the transition of time that it took.
Right.
Like one of the earlier landscape photographs that he mentioned, they were taken over a very long period of time. They weren't all taken at the same time, but he was able to kind of mix and match and fill in spots that he thought he could have done better. And I just think that that's when you become what I might call like a master photographer. It's like, you know, you can spot where you may have missed in the past and like how you're going to be able to fill that gap and make it all work in the end.
Yeah.
And he's always been able to do that and then talk about it and share it and teach people along the way.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I'm hearing from both of us is like, not that we're biased or anything, but the people that have this love of the craft of photography, I think we're very drawn to, but also people who, and this is the other thing we talk about a lot, are a part of the photo community that are very involved with the photo community. I think there's this nice symbiotic relationship with photographers and those photographers that are supporting other photographers.
Yes. And I honestly, and the more we talk about it, the more I think about it, and as we continue, makes me
realize that it's literally a requirement in order to excel in this industry. Like, you kind of have to be a part of that community.
Yeah, it's literally a requirement not to be an asshole.
Then why am I here?
Why are you here? Who are you?
I thought I was the asshole.
We all are.
I'm the fall guy of the Diffusion Tapes.
Oh yeah, you are. Definitely are. That's the way it's got to be.
I mean, if somebody's got to do it, you know, that's okay.
That's why I asked you to do it. I was like, I need a fall guy.
That's right. I need a stooge.
I'll make him do all the ice breaking and then blame him for all the fails.
Yeah, you look way smarter when I make a fool of myself. That's right. All I got to say.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm the editor, so.
Yeah, that's true.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, I have no power here.
Yeah, exactly. I make myself sound great and make you sound foolish.
Hey, as long as I'm part of the community, that's all that matters.
It's all good.